So you get a frustrated animal, basically. And it's a bit of a tricky one to wrap your head around. But what you can do is, if the horse isn't getting enough quality forage, so they're a bit hungry, and then you start to try and train them with food. So you're attempting positive reinforcement, adding something to increase behavior. But what you might actually be is negatively reinforcing them, because they want to escape the state of hunger, which is aversive. So they do the behavior to escape that uncomfortable feeling inside. So it's not positive reinforcement at all. But that's, you know, quite tricky kind of quadrant stuff. But it just means that we haven't got that step one that I talked about earlier about, you know, happy, calm, safe, relaxed. We're not at the right juncture to even be training the animal if we don't have those things in place.
Welcome to the Anthrozoology Podcast, Part 14, which continues with Part 2 of our Anthrozoology Speak series. Today we continue our conversation with Emma McLean of Hound Charming, where Emma speaks of her force-free training methodology and how she works with other than human animals and their guardians to create harmonious relationships. Whether dog, cat or horse, Emma's insight, understanding and training help her see how to solve relationship conflict without force.
Hi, I'm Michelle Sidlowski. I'm an assistant professor at Beacon College in Leesburg, Florida, and a member of the University of Exeter EASE group.
Hi, I'm Chris. I'm doing my PhD with Exeter University, and also a member of the EASE group.
Hiya, I'm Emma McLean. I'm the founder of Hound Charming. I also work as a horse trainer, force-free at Horse Charming, and I'm a qualified canine behaviourist.
Hello, my name's Sarah Oxley-Heaney and I'm a part-time PhD student at the University of Exeter, and I'm also a member of the EASE group. So do you find some people who approach you, if you can't kind of guarantee that they will be able to ride, or if they realise that's not your focus, do people then kind of like say, oh, you know, force-free training is not for me then?
Yeah, all the time. But we're really selective about who we will and won't take on as clients now, because over the years we've had, you know, a number of those kind of comings and goings and sort of, you know, well, they didn't kind of, you know, it didn't work for us type thing. And we've just got really, really skilled at weeding out the people we do want to work with. We want to preach to the choir, basically, rather than convert, I think, you know. We want someone who's at least open-minded and willing to kind of listen. You know, the yeah, but parade is not for us, really.
But I did want to bring up, too, that so here in the US, there was kind of this push around that, you know, in the 1980s to start thinking about that reluctance of animals to enter the veterinary clinic, right? That there was sort of this push to, gee, you know, dogs and cats don't really like going to the veterinary clinic. And then there was sort of this gap of time that nobody did anything about it. And then in the, you know, to the 2000s, it sort of came back to the public sphere in the US. And at that point I was a veterinary technician. And when this whole fear-free training program came out, that, you know, Dr. Becker started, essentially all of the techs in veterinary clinics looked at each other and went, duh, we've been doing this for 20 years. Why is this a thing now? Mm-hmm. And it very much was us, you know, telling clients what we've always told them, that you need to bring your dog into the vet on a regular basis and just walk through the office, get a treat, leave, you know, that sort of socialization for the vet. So I just was wondering what it is that you think keyed off this, look, we're suddenly concerned about white coat syndrome in animals. When people in the field have been doing this sort of fear-free thing for decades, all of a sudden now it's a cool thing to do.
I can only assume, really, it's just the growth of force-free training in the dog world. And, you know, obviously, back to that point about the physical kind of aspect and their health and stuff. So it's like this kind of umbrella or layer on, I don't know if you've seen the Do No Harm hierarchy of dog needs, but obviously the health perspective is addressed there, and fear-free veterinary practices and handling is you know, is mentioned there. And it's because of that holistic aspect. It's like you can't be sort of training the dog, or we don't want to be training the dog force free in these other areas, but then, oh, it's time for the vet, let's get it in a headlock and shove this in its mouth and this up its bum, and you know, have the animal totally stressed out. So it's about preparing them for these stressful situations in advance, so that they cease to become stressful, I suppose. That's the ideal. It's hard, don't get me wrong, it's hard, because you know, there's always a dog that needs emergency treatment and we haven't had time to train it, or he's a rescue and he's terrified of people, so, and his claws are digging in and force has to be used. And that's why I said earlier, you know, it's that ideal, it's knowing that we should do these things where possible, but accepting that sometimes, you know, it's not appropriate and we just have to do what's best to save the animal's life or for its health or well-being. So I think it's probably just the rise of force-free training kind of itself and the growth in popularity. I mean, you've only got to look at a group like Do No Harm and how huge it is and the rate that it grows. I'm one of the moderators there, and you know, it's hundreds of requests to join the group every single day, and you know, 20 or more questions you know, from members wanting to know information. And I think it's a great thing. I think it's a great thing that, you know, people have been willing to stick their necks out and say, like, it's not okay to shock a dog, it's not okay to choke a dog, and, you know, and dare to be different, because, you know, there's so much stuff still on TV of really punitive training. I mean, I kind of grew up watching all that stuff and just thought you had to do that to a dog in order to have a safe dog. And now I realize it's the complete opposite of that. You know, it's you create problems by treating animals that way. But we're fed it. And I think we'll come on to that later a little bit. It's about the conditioning of us as humans, you know, to believe that animals are there, you know, to kind of serve us in some way or be subservient to us, and that's just not how it should or needs to be. So I can only assume that it's just the growth of the kind of force-free training system, which I think, you know, is an amazingly good thing. And we're way behind with horses, about 30 years behind, I'd say, in terms of progress, but it started, at least the wheels are in motion. And you know, people like Max kind of who stick their neck out, you know, to improve, you know, the welfare and training of horses globally. It's just, you know, amazing really that we've got these people around, I think.
Why do you think it's grown so much in, Michelle, why do you think it's grown so much in the Middle East as well? I mean, it's not huge in the Middle East, but I see you've got lots of clients from the Middle East. I'm intrigued why there specifically.
People are really weirded out by that. They're like, really? They just don't understand how a girl from Essex has got an 80%, you know, Cairo-based clients.
Well, actually, from the other side, as somebody who lived in the Middle East for 16 years, I'm surprised that people are interested in force-free training. And I think it's fantastic, but it's a weird connect.
I think there's definitely this kind of generation of young sort of liberal thinking, open-minded kind of people living in Cairo. There seems to be, I mean, they're just lovely people, and they don't want to hurt or scare their dogs in order to train them. And they probably grew up with a bit of kind of punitive stuff going on, because that's just how it is culturally there sometimes. And they sort of go, no, I don't want that for my dog, you know, I want to do something different. And then they start looking for an alternative, and unfortunately there still isn't that boots on the ground in Egypt or Saudi or Jordan. So then they start to kind of search and eventually find me, because it's a really weird kind of thing. But basically a few years ago I was obviously doing my dog training very small scale, just based, you know, in Essex where I live, and I was moderating Do No Harm, and somebody in Cairo asked for a remote trainer, and I was like, oh, what about me? And we just really hit it off, me and this woman, and she had 3 Beledi puppies, and she happened to be somebody very influential in Cairo, and she started going, she's brilliant, she's amazing. Oh. And then everyone started going, who are you? And it's just kind of snowballed from there, really. So I got a very lucky break. She was like my springboard client, if you like, and I'll always be eternally grateful to her. And you know, I love people as much as I love animals, and I think that can be quite rare sometimes. Like you sort of get a lot of animal people that are really into animals but maybe not so much into people, but I really love just working on the relationship with the human as much as anything. And like some of these people I'll be friends with for life, I know that, you know. And I'll be, you know, we talk and we sort of talk about everything, not just dogs, you know. And it's really about having friendships or a family, it's not just about client work, do you know what I mean? And like Max kind of showed me that model and that it could work, because I was always, well, you know, business is business and pleasure is pleasure and never the two shall meet. And she actually showed me a way through modeling between our relationship, mine and her relationship, that you can have both. And so I have both with my client base for the most part. Not everybody wants it or needs it, and you know, but we have a lot of really good friends in Hound Charming. And like I was chatting to somebody this morning and she was like, well, you've just adopted half of Cairo now, haven't you? And I was like, yeah, that's exactly how it is. I love it, absolutely love it.
You were mentioning about good positive reinforcement training and not so good positive reinforcement training. I think I've experienced the latter myself, thinking I was doing the right thing. And actually, now I look back upon it and I reflect, I think that wasn't somebody that I wanted to be when I went to this particular course. Mm-hmm. And I realized that actually the animals that were the objects of the course, I probably was part of their, I don't think they particularly had a very good time. There was no hands-on or anything like that, but the method of that was being taught, I think was definitely in using vision as force, for example, and possibly voice as force, and energy, myself as force. Mm. So yeah, you can tell us a bit about what you think about.
Yeah, so I mean, positive reinforcement training with horses in particular gets a really bad press, or can do. And the reason for that is kind of circles back to what we were talking about earlier, where horses are kept in suboptimal conditions. So they're not being fed enough forage, they're not getting enough turnout with their friends. So what you have, or what you're starting with, is a frustrated animal. So then when you try to start to train them to do certain behaviours with food, they've got this kind of edge to them, which is, give me the food and I'll do this behaviour because I know that's the route to it, but I'm peed off, basically. And you see it a lot. You'll see ears back, or in geldings, you often see that they drop their penis. And that's a sign of emotional conflict in a horse, or can be, or should be considered to be, when you've got somebody training it with food. If you see them drop their penis, that may be indicative of a horse who's in emotional conflict. You can't look at that in isolation, but you know, if you look at the horse's overall kind of demeanor, and it's because I want the food, but I don't want to be near you, or I don't want to do this behavior, or the behavior is too hard, or you're not explaining it correctly, so I'm frustrated, or I haven't been out of my stable for 16 hours and now you're asking me to do this in return for the stuff that I think is, you know, should be abundant anyway, like forage or hay or chopped grass or whatever. So you get a frustrated animal, basically. And it's a bit of a tricky one to wrap your head around, but what you can do is, if the horse isn't getting enough quality forage, so they're a bit hungry, and then you start to try and train them with food. So you're attempting positive reinforcement, adding something to increase behavior. But what you might actually be is negatively reinforcing them, because they want to escape the state of hunger, which is aversive. So they do the behavior to escape that uncomfortable feeling inside. So it's not positive reinforcement at all. But that's, you know, quite tricky kind of quadrant stuff. But it just means that we haven't got that step one that I talked about earlier about, you know, happy, calm, safe, relaxed. We're not at the right juncture to even be training the animal if we don't have those things in place, basically. And we will say to people, if you don't have that in place with your own animal on any given day, walk away. Don't start training them with food, you know, because you end up in a whole mess if you start trying to add food into a frustrated or conflicted, you know, animal. So yeah, that's kind of what I mean by not so good positive reinforcement or attempts at.
Well, and that's one of the articles that I was reading in preparation for this podcast was a Lewis article on exactly that thing, that if our focus is exclusively on what she calls manipulation and coercion, where we're doing exactly what you said, we have a hungry animal, we're plunking food in front of it. So it's fighting against itself. What we're doing is, in her words, reducing them to automatons, that they're responding to a binary input. They're not making choices and we're not allowing them to communicate with us. We're skipping the communication step and instead just going straight to that shove food in their mouth, which is, again, that it is punishment because it is withdrawing resources, withdrawing social interaction if they don't behave. So yeah, it very much is something that's supposedly positive reinforcement, but is actually, you know, negative, which I think about the training of marine species and how a withdrawal of food or withholding of food that may actually result in death of animals, you know, starving to death is very, very common with marine animals. And it's just a terrible, terrible training method. In my view. I'm not a marine, trainer, but seems bad.
Yeah, there's a lot of frustrated animals being trained with food, I think, you know, so it's really important as a budding force-free trainer, if you're sort of listening and wanting to kind of try this with your animals, I think, is to get professional help to do it right, because it's so much easier and better to do it right from the start than try and fudge it on your own, get it completely wrong, and then end up with a really peed off animal who's kind of more difficult to manage than they were before, potentially. That's what you could end up with.
And I think it goes back to what Sarah was saying about Foxy, and that it was a matter of waiting and waiting for that communication method of communication to arise before anything else can happen.
Yeah, it was an interesting thing with Foxy, because what we did, from my perspective, what I sort of saw happening is we looked at what Sarah was already doing, and she was already doing a really good job, but there were certain elements that he wasn't enjoying. So we tried to remove or minimize those elements as far as possible, but withstanding, you know, acknowledging that he has to have his nappy change, that isn't up for debate, basically, that has to be done. But let's strip away the pieces of the puzzle that he really isn't enjoying, and the bits that he is enjoying, let's make him enjoy those even more. So, you know, he was getting tummy rubs and kind of, you know, lots of petting for laying still, because obviously that helps with the nappy change itself if he's not kind of all over the place. And we developed, you know, this kind of calm stroking thing rather than a playful thing, because we tried different things and we found that that sort of thing really helped him stay more motionless. And I think, like you said earlier, he then started to see the value in the nappy change itself, because we'd taken away the aversive bits to the best of our ability. And we didn't use any food with him, because Sarah was very strict with me. And I did have a little, oh my God, how are we going to do it without food? But she was like, no food. And I was like, But she assured me that he does like petting, and he really does. And I've got a cool little video, actually, of she signals to him that nappy change time, because he's got this blue towel, and she sort of signals to him, and he comes over, has his nappy changed, and at the end he kind of flips over onto his tummy again and immediately wants more strokes. So that tells me that experience for him was not something he wanted to escape or avoid, and that was a really, you know, important shift. And now he's actually communicating, I need my bum changed. My mind is just completely blown by that. Even though I know this stuff is possible, I'm just like, this is crazy good.
And it was interesting with the lack of food, because what I don't want is diarrhea. So that's why there was a no food policy, because I wanted him. And in a way, I hadn't really thought about it, but it ties in with what you're saying, that food is a thing that he should have access to all the time, I guess. And because I wasn't allowing him treats, which is the food that we were talking about, because those are generally the ones they really love with the coloured E numbers in, and that's what creates the problem. Mm. It was so strange, because it definitely wasn't one-sided. He was showing me. Mm. And that was just absolutely awesome, you know.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know so much about cats as you do. You know, I know with a horse, they need access to food pretty much all the time. I mean, my understanding is cats kind of eat when they want to eat. So I didn't think anything of it in that sense, like, oh, it's not, we should be providing him food. I just thought, oh, he better find petting reinforcing, because otherwise we're not reinforcing him. We need a reinforcer. But thankfully, you were absolutely right in your assessment of that, and he did find it reinforcing enough. Because often people go, oh, I'm training my dog to sit, but I don't use treats, I just use praise. And I'm like, please, no. That's not sufficient, you know, to strengthen and maintain a behavior. We want a powerful reinforcer. And yes, there are dogs out there that value their owner's affection and attention, but for the most part, when you want to build and strengthen a behavior, you need a primary reinforcer such as food. But thankfully in Foxy's case, we got away without it.
So isn't this sort of along the same lines of something we're all keenly interested in, and that's sort of the decommodification of other than human animals, in that looking at them as individuals as opposed to a species, you know, looking at Foxy as Foxy as opposed to approaching Foxy from this is how we train cats, or approaching I've forgotten your horse's name,
Flint,
yeah, approaching him as Flint as opposed to a horse, and realizing that just like, you know, us and our friends, we build different relationships, and we reinforce those relationships in very different ways. And I think that that's key to this whole conversation, is recognizing the individuality and the individual preferences as opposed to species level preferences.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And the reason that neither myself nor Max will just sell somebody, you know, a template to follow and go, see ya. Do you know what I mean? We want the ongoing dialogue, so we can, by video, so we can get to know that individual animal. Yes, we have instructions that are templates for people to follow, but along the journey, we're always tweaking and going, this particular horse doesn't like that step in our protocol, so we're going to do it differently for him. And this came up with Flynn in our early training, because appeasement gestures in horses, calming signals, de-escalation techniques. One of those things can be licking and chewing. You've probably heard, oh, he's processing it, he's calming down, he's licking and chewing. That's kind of, you know, natural horsemanship language. But so initially my coach, who was looking at my videos, kind of said, well, he's licking a little bit, you know, perhaps he's a bit anxious, perhaps we need to change things. And what we did was we did observations of Flynn just eating when I wasn't around. So I set up my camera to find out, what is his natural eating style? Does he lick his lips when there's no human, when there's no training going on? And what we found was actually he does. He's a licky, nibbly eater. So then we could go, okay, well, in this case, this is normal for him. So it's very much an individual thing, like you say, not kind of one size fits all approach at all. That's why we really sort of like value the bespoke, personalized coaching approach.